This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Eric Newton. Today we have another piece from WOOC correspondent Dave Pablo at the Northeast Organic Farming Association's recent winter conference.
And we have a local interior designer here with us today on a live interview.
Afterwards, an interview with activist Barbara Smith. She sat down with correspondent Melissa Bromley to discuss the launch of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival.
And then we have a local photographer discussing her project, Scrappin', in New York State. Let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local news. The New York Times Union reports that the Troy City Police Department will have new leadership and will begin new training with the federal government to improve its communication and interaction with city residents. Troy City Mayor Patrick Madden said that he and his staff had been meeting with the U.S. Department of Justice's Community Relations Service Office to develop specific practices to maximize the community's engagement. A new form of a police objective review committee, which has been defunct, also will be undertaken.
President Donald Trump on Friday accused top officials at the Department of Justice and the FBI of favoring Democrats, even though many of them are actually Republicans. The president's comment came hours after he greenlighted the release of a controversial secret memo authored by congressional Republicans that alleges the FBI abused U.S. spying law investigating Trump's campaign. The FBI this week urged Congress not to release the memo, saying it contained misleading and inaccurate information. Democrats, meanwhile, have said the memo is just another attempt by Republicans to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into the Trump campaign and Russian meddling.
The New York Times reports the White House is growing increasingly impatient with senior military officials at the Pentagon over the lack of a strategy for a preventive military strike against North Korea. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster's has reportedly pressed military leaders for a strategy due to his desire to keep all options on the table. But Pentagon officials worry that presenting the White House with a strategy will make a preventive strike more likely.
The Times Union reports that Sean Hawkins, a veteran Schenectady County jail guard, remains on unpaid leave and will be forced into early retirement as punishment for sexually harassing several women on the medical staff at the facility. However, he will be allowed to remain on staff for another 20 months. Hawkins will be relocated to the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift to restrict his interaction with the medical staff and will forfeit the vacation time he had accrued.
In ongoing corruption trial of Governor Cuomo's former top aide, Joe Perricocco, prompted a fierce internal debate over the ethics and legality of paying $7,500 a month to a spouse's aide. Federal prosecutors alleged that Lisa Perricocco was paid nearly $287,000.
The New York Public Interest Research Group today urged Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers to ban the use of plastic bags in retail outlets across New York State. NYPIRG argued that the governor advanced a plan modeled on California's law as part of any 30-day budget amendments due to be issued later this month. NYPIRG's call follows the failure of the government's plastic bag task force to make a policy recommendation for New York regarding plastic bags. Last year, the governor had blocked a New York City law restricting plastic bags, but had promised to propose a state solution to plastic bags.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC, Hudson Mohawk Magazine, 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we have a very special guest in the studio with us. She's a local girl and an interior designer. You know, tell our guests, our listeners, your name and the name of your company.
Hi, everybody. This is Carmisha with Interiors by Carmisha, where we focus in-house on interior design, general contracting, and design build, where we can take you from beginning to end in your design projects, whether it be something so small as a small bedroom, bathroom, or you're just starting off on a business venture. So we're here to help everybody who's just want to know how to get started in interior design, getting those projects off the ground, or getting through some problem-solving kind of solutions. And,
you know, one of the things I was excited when you know, I called you and we started talking about your business, I was excited to hear that, you know, a person can redesign an apartment. You know, you don't have to be a homeowner. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't own homes, but they look at their apartment and they go, man, I really should do something. You know, I should improve my space a little bit.
Right. Of course.
And so I was excited to hear that you would actually help someone in an apartment. It doesn't have to be a homeowner.
Oh, no. And I mean, even if you're renting out a space that you want to make it specialized to your needs and, you know, your hobbies, your atmosphere, things you like to have around you. And it doesn't really cost a lot. People keep going back to that, oh, it costs so much. No, most times I find everything in the person's house, in their person's space, even in the environment. We can go right outside and I probably can find a nice table, a chair. People put stuff out on the curb all the time. So design is really affordable if you're able to have an open mind about it.
And so how did you get into becoming an interior designer?
Well, it's always been a passion of mine. I've just always loved it. I went to school for interior design, so I have a two-year degree in interior design and a four-year degree in business administration. Believe it or not, I've been in the industry for 19 years.
19 years. I believe it.
Learning, speccing, understanding the product, how they should be installed properly, the pros and cons of certain products, what's best to what you should use in certain applications, what you shouldn't. And I've been able to learn how to pretty much build a house. I can do everything from the roof right down to the foundation. So if you have a leaky foundation or your foundation cracks and you don't have the budget to haul in a huge truck, we can come in and show you how to do it just out of the bags you find in like the stores around your neighborhood.
So, I mean, it sounds like a, you know, all-around girl here. You can design my apartment and you can fix my foundation at the same time.
Definitely.
Come on, Eric.
Yeah.
That's some work,
that is,
man.
Very impressive. So if someone wanted to start with completely redesigning a room in their house, what would you say is the very first thing they have to do?
The first thing is really to identify your style. Like, just like you get dressed in the morning, you kind of pick out your outfit. You kind of want to figure out, how do I want my bedspread to look, or what do I want my toilet to look like? Depending on whatever room you're redesigning or updating, remodeling, whatever you want to call it, figure out what style you want. And then once you have that style figured out, and you can easily figure it out based on the stuff around your house, how you dress, again, things in the atmosphere is really not, doesn't have to be anything complicated. It can be, I think Livonia mentioned, what if I give you this shirt, can you design this my bedroom around this shirt? Yes, we absolutely can design this bedroom around your shirt. We have those crazy requests all the time. We've had people, can you design this around my dog's collar? Okay, we have to do it.
Would you say that's your craziest request you've ever had for an inspiration?
Design this around my dog collar? Yeah, because
that's the crazy one.
yeah, because it's like, you know, it's real life. You either need a bathroom remodel or you don't. You either need a kitchen remodel or you don't. Or you either really want to update your space or you don't. And people want to update their space for a number of reasons, just because it's outdated. You change. As we grow, we change. We want a fabulous space for our fabulous times we're going through in life. So, or we want a cool, calm, collective space. Whatever floats your boat, we're here to make the process simple, easy, and friendly, because design is scary. So we don't want it to be scary for anybody. Again, it's just like getting dressed in the morning, matching your clothes with your shoes, and all that.
So what's the average budget for designing, or let's say a bedroom? Let's say if I wanted to like get new furniture? Would I have to pick out the store, or would you help? Would you walk to the store with me and help me pick out stuff in the store and say, hey, you know, I got, let's say I got $1,000, which I very rarely have $1,000, but sometimes I have some money.
Sometimes.
And let's say I have $1,000. Would you go with me to the store and say, hey, Carmisha, can you help me redo my bedroom for $1,000?
Definitely, absolutely, hands down, without a doubt. And I could probably leave you some money in the budget for like after snacks kind of thing, like appetizers. I am the clearance queen. I love the clearance rack. You can find such modern things on the clearance rack. I'm sorry, I am her. I love finding things outside. I know that's so weird. And I'm not a garbage picker, I swear. But the best things are in the garbage. People throw out so many things. And then local communities have, I don't want to call it National Dump Day, but it's specific days you can empty out your attics, your cellars, and either they'll do it for a small fee or do it for free at that time of the year. Right. So that's a great time to be looking for stuff. If you're on a budget, college students are always on a budget. And you know you're not going to keep a lot of this stuff all the time because, again, we change and our tastes change. So just have fun with it. And that's where you can keep the budget really to a minimum when you allow creativity to come in.
I like that. I mean, I think my style, I think I like modern furniture, at least furniture. I like modern furniture, but homes, I like colonial homes, but a colonial home and modern furniture don't really go together. But that's what I like. I like that colonial home from the outside. But when you get in the inside, I like having a modern look. It's sort of, they're different from each other. They contrast each other, I think.
Right, definitely. And that's what I also want to bring to this area and let people know. Design is everything. It's not traditional. It's not contemporary. It's everything. It's traditional, modern. We all mix. We all come from different areas in this world. And you definitely want to put your own flair and influences, cultural backgrounds into your space. So we definitely have the ability to mix all that together and give you a space that can definitely come out beautiful. And you'll be able to sustain long after we're gone. Because we like to teach you how to install it or put it in and then keep it looking beautiful. Just simple techniques, like instead of throwing the pillow on the couch, if you just stand that up every day, that'll look like Martha Stewart left. You make your bed, you stand your pillow up, it's like, ooh, Martha Stewart was here. But she really wasn't. It was you. So just little things like that can give you a beautiful space.
Do you find that, fashion, interior design has trends that come in and out of style and are more popular one year and then maybe fall off the next?
Definitely. But I guess as I'm becoming a more versed designer, nothing really ever goes out of style. You just got to find the client looking for it.
Right.
I know that's very complex, but I love Baroquean, that era, and it's hard to find someone who likes that type of furniture, the type of stuff that comes out of that era. But if you look, there's a lot of today's things that have been built off of those architectural details. So design really never goes out of style. If you think about like our downtown areas, those buildings were built to last and always be like iconic and always have some kind of design. And, you know, they were built with people's hands back then. Now we have all these modern technologies. So no, design, I would say, it just really doesn't. I don't feel like it does.
So how can people contact you? What's the contact number, website, Facebook page? I mean, how can people reach out to you and say, hey, help me with this apartment?
Definitely. The best way to reach out to me, because everybody knows it, is to go to Facebook. Everybody's using that. That seems to be the easiest medium for younger, old, veterans or rookies. Facebook.com, and it's Interiors by Space Carmisha. And you can also reach me by phone, 518-505-8744. I'm also reachable by email. And that's ibc.inquiries@gmail.com. So whatever is the easiest way for you to reach me, certainly utilize those options. And it doesn't have to be a huge paragraph. It could be something as simple as help, and we'll respond, and we'll definitely help you get to your whatever you need to accomplish.
I thank you so much. I'm glad that you're here. I think being able to provide interior design to the average person is great. Homeowners, business owners, apartment dwellers, anyone who's really looking for someone to help them with their interior design. We thank you so much for joining us here at 103.5. Yes, WOOC, thank you for coming in.
Thank you guys so much.
All right.
Thank you. And for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
Ooh, I made it.
To learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, please visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC correspondent Dave Publo attended the Northeast Organic Farming Association's New York Winter Conference in January and had a chance to interview Elizabeth Henderson. Elizabeth was a founder of Piecework Organic CSA, one of the oldest CSAs in the United States, where she farmed for over 30 years. She is also the author of the book on CSA farming called Sharing the Harvest. As you'll immediately hear, she's involved with many, many things that impact organic farming, especially in New York State.
My name is Elizabeth Henderson. I've been an organic farmer since about 1979. My farm was Piecework Organic Farm in Newark, New York. I've been a member of the board of NOFA New York on and off for many years. I'm currently on the board. And I also represent NOFA New York on the Interstate Council. There are 7 NOFA chapters, and we lightly coordinate through an interstate council. And I represent all the NOFAs on the board of the Agricultural Justice Project, which does food justice certification, and also on the IFOAM North America board.
My first interaction with you was when you were a panel member on activism. I think the Farm Bill might have been part of that as well. So what are the issues that you're focused on these days? And let's just start with that one.
Well, I co-chair the Policy Committee of NOFA New York, and the policy issues that we are working on are the Farm Bill, the 2018 Farm Bill. We've been trying for many years to maintain the integrity of the National Organic Program, so we're still at that. It's not an easy equation because big businesses see that they can make some money by buying up small organic businesses, and then they put pressure for those businesses to behave more like conventional ones. So there are lots of arguments over ingredients that these companies say they just have to have in order to produce whatever it is. So the issues that we care about particularly are maintaining the cost share program, which pays for up to 75% of the certification fees, which is an important cost share for small farms.
Because otherwise it's hard to be certified organic and have that be affordable, correct?
Certification became more expensive when the National Organic Program took it over. And that was the reason that there was an agreement to institute this cost share, because it really did double the cost of certification. Because when the accreditation by the federal government is expensive. They oversee the certifiers that oversee the farms. So other issues that we are concerned about are on the level of New York State and also regionally and nationally is that organic farms have been doing a really good job of building healthy soil. That's the central focus of organic farms. And when you're building healthy soil, what you're doing is you're increasing the carbon in the soil. You're taking it out of the air, where it's a problem with CO2, and you're putting it in the soil where it's doing a lot of good things. It's buffering the soil against weather extremes. It's increasing the nutrient density of the crops that you grow there. So there are various schemes that people are working on to encourage farmers, to incentivize them to put more carbon in the soil. And we want to make sure that organic farmers are recognized for the work that we've been doing and compensated for that if other farms are going to be compensated, that we're not left out of whatever happens.
With the Farm Bill coming up and the disposition of the current administration. What are, first of all, the most hopeful avenues that you hope to pursue, and what are some of the major roadblocks that you see ahead of you?
I don't know what's going to happen with the Farm Bill, and nobody seems to know when exactly it's going to happen, whether it'll be in the next couple months or it could drag out a very long time. The organic and sustainable movement has been able to get really just some small crumbs off the big ag table through years and years of work. A very large coalition of organizations like NOFA. We work with the National Sustainable Ag Coalition on broader farming issues. We work with the National Organic Coalition on organic integrity. And we're just going to keep slogging away at those things. None of this work gets at the macro problem, which is that family-scale farms in this country and around the world are having a struggle to survive because of industrialized agriculture and the tremendous amount of consolidation that's happened in both marketing and input production.
Mm-hmm. I interned at a couple of different farms out in Washington State, and then I became for a year a manager of an aggregation site for the Puget Sound Food Hub. And I found the food hub to be a hopeful thing because we plugged in more than 60 farms, many of which were up in Whatcom County, and gave them access to the Seattle market that they'd never had before.
I've toured that food hub,
okay.
Bow Hill Farm.
Sure, Bow Hill Blueberries with Harley, yes.
Yeah, I've been there. The Domestic Fair Trade Association had one of our meetings up there.
I see that as a hopeful type of model for plugging farmers in and giving them a chance to actually make a living using a small-scale organic format.
Well, I think farms that aren't selling direct through farmers markets or through community-supported agriculture absolutely need to form cooperatives and aggregate and do food hubs. The thing about those food hubs is it's important that they be paying prices that allows the farms to manage financially, and that they provide living wage jobs to the people who work for them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just another form of wholesaling that, you know, won't really save the farms.
Speaking of which, do you know much about the details of Cuomo's proposal regarding the farm to school?
I don't know the details of that. The other policy thing that we're working on in New York is a New York Organic Action Plan. Because we've been doing a lot of reacting over the years to label GMOs, stop using this pesticide, or don't spray that. And what we've wanted to do is put out a positive program of where we would like things to go. So we would like New York to become an ecological state, and where having access to land and access to high-quality food are considered human rights. So that's our sort of broad set of goals, and we want to work towards those over the next 20 years.
So, yeah, I agree on the active versus reactive approach, and that sounds like at least the germination of a plan. If farmers or other people who are just interested in farming, especially organic farming, want to plug into that effort, is there some way for them to do so?
This will all be up on the NOFA New York website, NOFANY.org, as our former executive director called it, nofanning.org. So we're going to be posting the plan. We've got parts of it up already and on our website so people can read about it and find ways to plug into it.
Great. And are there any other things that you think our listeners should know about?
Well, I just wanted to add about the action plan is that it starts with what each person can do as an individual, and then looks at what you can do in your village or town, and then the county level, the state level, and the federal level. So there will be lots of different kinds of activities that people can do on whatever level they want to plug in.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So that was That was the Day Pueblo interview with Elizabeth Henderson at the recent NOFA-NY Winter Conference.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory. You're listening to WOC 105.3 FM, Troy, the Sanctuary.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for independent media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Last Monday was the Capital Region's launch of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. WOOC News correspondent Melissa Prumley was there among the hundreds of others and caught up with local author, professor, and activist leader Barbara Smith, who helped out together with the event.
I'm here with Barbara Smith. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Good. We're here at the Poor People's Campaign launch in the Capital Region, which you helped coordinate. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, I'm a part of the planning group for this event this evening, and also I am on the coordinating committee for New York State Poor People's Campaign.
And how did you end up on that committee?
Well, a certain person named Joe Paparone asked if I might get involved with the Truth Commission process that happened last year. We had three Truth Commissions around New York State, one in Cuba, New York, which is way out west, one in Schenectady in July, and then there was one on Long Island in September. So I was one of the Truth Commissioners, and that was kind of the building blocks for the Poor People's Campaign.
And how do you feel the launch went tonight?
Oh, I'm so thrilled. I think those of us who worked on it and planned it are just absolutely pleased with how many people came in particular. It's a January night. It's not the coldest of January nights, but it's not 70 degrees either. People are really, I think, drawn to what this is. People are very upset about the state of things, the present state of things. Tomorrow is a State of the Union, ha-ha, the State of the Disunion speech. People want to be active and do things, and I think this gives them a really great opportunity, particularly because it's a way of organizing that brings people in and is so inclusive. We want it to be inclusive.
And it's connected to religion. Is that a necessity? What do you think about that?
One does not need to be a religious person to be involved, and I'm the poster child for that fact. I am not in any way involved with organized religion, and I actually have questions sometimes about the faith focus. I've said from the very beginning of my being involved that we have to get people who are concerned about these issues from a secular perspective involved too, because there are a whole lot of them. They're called organizers and activists in movements. There are a lot of people who have already been concerned about and have given their lives for addressing these very issues of poverty, racism, militarism, the environment, and more. So it's a nice mixture, I think, of people who come to it from a faith perspective and people like myself who come from to it with a pure social justice and activism perspective.
So that's a lot of issues that you just ran through, and there's a lot that this campaign is taking on. What do you see as possible for this campaign?
Well, what's exciting is that this is a national movement. This is our Capital Region launch, but all over this nation, there are people coming together in similar numbers with similar levels of excitement about something called the Poor People's Campaign, because it is, I think, a great opportunity to raise movement work at this historical moment. I think there's a huge amount of potential, and it is what we make it. It becomes what we make it, and I think the more people who get involved with open hearts and with good spirits, that we will be able to accomplish a great deal. People don't really know what to do because of all the chaos that we have seen in our national, in our national political climate for more than the last year. We see white supremacy writ large. We see the 1% getting billions or trillions of dollars in tax breaks from a so-called tax reform bill. We see people being deported, people going into 7-Elevens and waiting outside of schools where parents are dropping off their children. All kinds of atrocities are happening, and often we feel so helpless, and this is a way to address those issues and many more.
You mentioned the past year. Earlier, I think it was Reverend Emily McNeil mentioned that this campaign is actually like 10 years in the making. Is that the case? And what are your feelings on how this campaign, the context of this campaign outside of the presidential administration?
Well, I do know. I wasn't aware of that 10 years in the making, and I want to hear more about that. I know that the Moral Mondays movement that Reverend William Barber was the face of and initiated in North Carolina when he was president of the statewide NAACP. I know that that's been one of the building blocks for the Poor People's Campaign. But I also do know that there was a plan to have a Poor People's Campaign whoever won the 2016 presidential election. Because guess what? Whoever won, we would still have poverty, we would still have racism, we would still have militarism, and we would still have ecological, environmental devastation. It would just have a different cast of characters. But those ongoing systemic oppressions, or as it's called by the campaign, evils, would still be in place. So that's good to know, that it's not necessarily aimed at party politics as they are so grievously playing themselves out at this present time.
You mentioned Reverend Barber, and of course the Poor People's Campaign originated with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And it seems like, although Reverend Barber is a driving force for this, he's not the one person leading the charge. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think that's good, and that shows that we've grown in 50 years. Martin Luther King did not do everything by himself either, but it was a time when a charismatic male leader was seen as being so much more expected than we would have that be the case now. We have gone through from civil rights to the women's movement, to the LGBTQIA movement, to constant and continuing union organizing around workers' rights. We have had people organizing around welfare. We have a disability rights movement. I'm leaving some out. We have an immigrant rights movement. We have so many different vital movements that have really unfolded since the 1960s. And those movements are places where people learn and grow. So to have something that would be absolutely a mirror image of what we were doing in the 60s, that would show that learning and growth did not happen. So I'm so glad that's your perception of what's going on, because that's what we wish to have be the case. He is a powerful, powerful speaker and leader. He is a powerful, powerful ethical leader and a spiritual leader. But the fact that it's a we as opposed to an I, that shows that we're making great progress.
Thank you, Barbara. And before I let you go, is there anything else that you think our listeners should know or that you want to share with the greater community?
Well, I just wanted to let people know that if they're interested in connecting to the Poor People's Campaign, they can look at the Poor People's Campaign website, which is poorpeoplescampaign.org. They can also go to our New York State Facebook page, which is Facebook, and if you just put in your search engine, I'm sure New York State Poor People's Campaign, it will pop right up. So that's really all I would say. And just keep looking out. If you connect through social media, keep looking out for opportunities where you can join in. There will be other meetings. I don't know if there'll be mass meetings like this one, but there will be other opportunities to jump in and do the work, because the work is huge.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was WOOC news correspondent Melissa Bromley interviewing Barbara Smith about the Poor People's Campaign, which launched here in the Capital District last Monday.
Next on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we ask, who are you? What do you want to do and be in the finite amount of time we are each given on planet Earth? These universal questions are at the heart of a new project by award-winning photographer, Guggenheim Fellow, and formerly incarcerated youth, Brenda Ann Keneally. She grew up in Albany and Troy and now documents the lives of people struggling to feel secure in their neighborhoods. WOOC correspondent Megan Marone sat down with Brenda to discuss her project with youth from Troy called Scrappin' in New York State. This is part of an extended conversation with Brenda on art, class, and culture.
It's almost ready to snow here in Maspeth, Queens, and I am here with Guggenheim Fellow, Pulitzer Prize nominee, documentary photographer Brenda Ann Keneally, also a formerly incarcerated youth, to speak with her about her project called Scrappin' in New York State, which is part of her organization called A Little Creative Class. So, Brenda, could you explain what Scrappin' in New York State is and how the young people of Troy could participate?
Hi, Megan. I think that you probably summed it up when you gave a few lines from my bio. I came to the conclusion, probably about a decade ago, that valuing all the experiences of my life was really important, and all of them have provided me with different strengths and also perspectives on life that have kept my path long and much broader than it might have been. So I finished a 13-year collaborative documentary, which is coming out as a book in April, and it's called Upstate Girls Unraveling Collar City. It's me and an extended family of young people, boys, girls, and their parents and kids on Sixth Avenue in Troy, New York. So as I was putting together all of their life stories that I've collected over the past 13 years, one of the things that we did during that time is that they all did scrapbooks. Scrapbooks included gathering bits of important papers, pictures, keepsakes, and writing a short life story. So as I incorporated these into the book, and I also have some of my own sort of personal ephemera and life experiences there that show what really kept me in Troy for 13 years, I began to see that telling the story was really, the young people, once they started, it was a unique experience as if no one had ever really asked them to sit quietly or anywhere and think and talk about themselves, and that that was a legitimate subject to write about and even put out into the world. So there was that. At the same time, I was listening to a lot of shows about the economy, thinking about Troy, thinking about Brooklyn, where I used to live, which has changed, and the way people make money and why it's such a struggle for people in my family and now my extended family on Sixth Avenue and beyond to access these opportunities that I keep hearing about in jobs that are upwardly mobile, that can change your life, that could actually maybe afford you some travel, seeing things beyond what's out your front door, and, you know, the material things like a better apartment, a better house, maybe even an education. And so what was very obvious through the stories and also my own feelings was that I felt a lot of shame about where I came from. And I also did not feel that I could connect to the wider world. And I saw the scrapbooks as a way to do that. What we offer through the residency, or what we hope to do, we've done one summer, is to invite youth from Troy first, and then we would expand throughout upstate New York, come and live in New York City for 2 weeks in a creative residency. We have fabulous mentors and artists that have become close friends throughout the years, and they work side by side with the young people on scrapbooks. That's what we did this summer. And we would tour publications, museums, go to the beach, many for the first time, explore different foods, many things that kids wouldn't have the opportunity to do in Troy. So the residency is great. However, when we started to put it into practice, the stumbling blocks were that most people were really afraid of things that they didn't know. And the scrapbooks are one thing that they really took to, and they were almost obsessed with writing their story. And as they were completed, there was a shedding of shame and a community that was built and a freedom then to feel supported by their new peers, mentors, and the perspective that they had on themselves to venture forth into some territory that might be fearful. And for some people, that could be a Whole Foods. Guess that's why they call it Whole Paycheck. So anyway, a long way around to say that the board and I and some of the young people learned through the first residency that doing the scrapbooks as a way to build community among the young people who may come and visit New York and their families is a really essential first step. And when you think about other practical applications, you need to be able to talk about yourself on a job application. You need to be able to talk about yourself if you go to college. You need to be able to talk about yourself with a degree of confidence that all your life experiences are valuable and have provided certain strengths that are unique to you, even when meeting new people that may change your life. So the scrapbooking, while it sounds like a kind of innocuous, simple act, and I think that's why we picked that platform, you don't have to have a fancy computer program. You don't have to know how to draw. It's an age-old act of just cutting things out with scissors. You don't even need scissors. You can tear them with your hands, putting them in a book, and anything goes. But when we look at these things then, as singularly and as a collection, they do become a history of voices that are not normally the base of what you read about in books, the way the United States, our country, our state, our neighborhoods, our social policies and laws have been formed. So it's at once a personal empowerment, a creative endeavor, a way to think about approaching a project to which there are no rules. The only thing is to think about ideas in your life that have been transformative. And that can be not necessarily your first, you know, job or when you got your driver's license or when your child was born. It might be something as universal as, what was the first time you ever recognized beauty? What was the first beautiful thing you ever saw? So there's those kind of questions. And then as the kids are done, we produce them in these little short multimedia films. They watch them in community. Usually someone, sometimes everyone cries. They all get to know each other and they realize that there are universal experiences. And all of this becomes a platform to inform conversation about youth from disadvantaged communities. It's not even disadvantage. It's just a culture. It's the landscape of these kids' lives and seeing where that can fit into other cultures that may have experiences that these kids want to access. So there's a lot of ways to kind of approach that, but I think the first way is to establish that thinking outside the box, just thinking about the most impractical, wild, sort of, help me.
Well, you mentioned access, and what I think is important is that access to opportunity is sometimes seen as like, well, you have to take advantage of that opportunity. You have to like go for it. But if your perspective on things is so closed off due to your experience or the way that you've been treated by people or systems that you wouldn't go for that access, then things remain closed to you. So access isn't just like whether somebody's opening a door for you or not, but also whether you'd even have the perspective or the willingness or the feeling of freedom. And you've used the word self-entitlement or a healthy self-entitlement to be able to walk through that door and have new experiences.
That was WOOC correspondent Megan Marone in part one of an extended discussion with artist Brenda Ann Keneally on her new project with the youth of Troy in Albany called Scrappin' in the New York State. Stay tuned to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Fridays to hear more about Brenda on art, class, and culture. And next, we have another segment of Reclaiming History. We'll be talking about cobblers, Those are people that repair shoes. Historically, one's shoes indicated where you were from the Roman sandal to the Egyptian sandal to the Indian moccasin. Your shoes told people the culture, whether you were a Dutch wearing a wooden shoe or not. And those cobblers are still with us today. We went to see Lev's Shoe and Leather Repair at 602 Central Avenue in Albany, New York. He's the last of a dying breed of cobblers.
This is Lavonia Mallory of WOOC 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary. I'm here at a very special place, a shoe repair store. This is part of the Reclaiming History segment. Tell me your name and the name of your business.
Lev Smilyansky, and it's a Lev Shoe and Leather Repair.
So as far as I can tell, you're the only shoe repair guy in Albany that I've been able to find. Is that true?
No, they got a couple more, yeah.
A couple more, yeah. And how long have you been in business?
Almost 30 years.
30 years you've been repairing shoes?
Yes.
And how did you learn the shoe repair business?
Oh, I learned this in Russia, yeah.
You learned it where?
In Russia.
In Russia. Are the shoes different than you were repairing in Russia?
Maybe slightly different, yeah.
What do you have to do to be a good shoe repairman?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Are you a good shoe repairer?
I hope.
You hope? Do you have a lot of return business?
Yes.
Hi there.
How are you?
Look like you got a customer right here. You bringing some shoes in?
No.
You are bringing shoes. I hope.
Why?
I'm just interviewing this gentleman about his very long-standing, successful
business.
Yes,
he's been business, here a long time.
Right?
He's been here a very, very long time.
And as far as I know, he's the only shoe repair guy in the
area. Albany.
In
yes.
Albany.
Yes.
And so when you have a pair of shoes that you don't want to throw out just because they run over.
Need a new heel.
Okay.
You need a new heel.
Of course.
And how much are those shoes they cost you?
A lot of money.
A lot of money. So you don't want to throw those out just because the heel's gone.
He's the guy.
He's the man. That's what
that's
I said.
That's right. Yeah. He's the guy right here. And that's crazy because you used to have a lot of shoe shops all over. Now it's like a lost art.
See, that's what I just told him.
It's dying care. Question. How soon do you need this? Because I will be closed next week for vacation. If it will be like by February 7th. It's okay. How soon do you need this?
Well, I'll take it near February 7th. It's no problem.
It's okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and it will be $20.
Okay.
Okay, yep. I will polish everything.
Thank you.
Okay, yep.
See,
Thank you.
He's been here a long time, and I always bought my shoes here. Gator boots, all kinds of things I've bought here.
Gator, because you don't want to throw out a pair of Gator shoes. Just because the heel run over or something like that. You want to be able to repair them.
You always repair them. Or, you know, normally I put rubber taps in certain things or whatever.
Okay.
But, of course, you can't just mess up the reptiles.
That's
you
right.
You can't mess up the reptiles.
You sure can't.
You
all
know?
Right.
You got to take it to somebody that's good.
That's right.
He's the last cobbler.
Cobbler. That's right. That's what it's called. A cobbler.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You've given me some more information, man. I wouldn't be able to do this interview.
Don't have to pay me.
Got you. Don't worry. I got you.
No. I don't like nobody to have me. All right, y'all.
Take care.
You too. Okay.
So you are a cobbler.
Yes.
That is the name.
Yes.
All right. So tell me about some of the machines you have here. So what is this machine? It looks pretty old, this one here.
It's a nails. It's all old here. It's all machine. It's all old here. Mm-hmm. It's everything. It's pretty old here.
Mm-hmm.
It's.
So what about this machine? What is that big machine over there doing?
Like I'm sanding the shoes here.
I needed a pocket sewn on some leather pants.
Bring and show to me. I think I can do it, but I have to see it.
All right.
Okay.
It, like thick leather, like this jacket is the leather pants is real thin. They light.
Yeah, it's okay. Just I have to see.
All right.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Thank you.
No worries. So, can you start up that machine over there?
Oh, it's too loud.
Too loud.
It's too loud here. Yeah. It's too loud here.
And what does that machine do?
I like it's a clean surface. I don't know how to explain it best in English. When I need like it's a clean something, I use yeah.
Okay. All right. So what's the best part about being a cobbler? What do you love about this business?
I tell you truth, it's a dying, like he says, yeah, it's a dying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's, you see, I'm working only 2 days a week now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going slow, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I hope I'm retired soon, yeah.
You hope to retire?
Yes.
And is there anyone going to take over the business when you retire?
No.
So when you retire, this business is going to retire with you?
Yes. Yeah.
That's a dying art form.
Yes. Yeah. You see, it's my son. He got his office here, and he is attorney. He is working here. And
so he's an attorney?
He's attorney, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And you are the cobbler?
Yes.
All right. Well, listen, tell the name of your business, your address, and your phone number in case they have a good pair of shoes they want to bring by.
It's a left shoe and leather repair. It's a 602 Central Avenue, Albany, New York.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a phone number?
518-459-3739.
And tell our customers, our listeners, your name one more time.
Lev.
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 L-E-V.
L-E-V, yeah.
L-E-V. All right, Lev. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on The Sanctuary.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Lev Malinsky of Lev's Shoe and Leather Repair, 602 Central Avenue in Albany, New York. The last of a cobbler that's a shoe repairman right here in the Capital District. And next, we have an in-studio interview.
Yes, with Giselle Guzman, who is joining us at WOOC to bring us a program on immigration in the age of Trump. So welcome, Giselle.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a bit about the program that you're planning?
I'm just planning to do a segment on immigrants and family members of immigrants, possibly post-Trump era, any stories, any situations that have happened to them, how they feel, just a lot of current events revolving immigration.
So we do have the dreamers, you know, people who are trying to stay here in the country. I mean, exciting stuff.
Yep. I will bring up a lot of issues like that. Hopefully people that I interview have stories or know people that are DACA recipients. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that, people are going to be open to sharing their stories about what's happening to them?
I feel like now people are so much more willing to share their stories.
Yeah.
Definitely, for sure. I have some stories of myself that have happened to me and my family members. I feel like now that everything is out there, it's blatant in people's faces, people are definitely willing to share.
You know, blatant, discrimination against people who want to stay in this country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's going to be some amazing storylines to talk to people, interviewing, I guess, whole families, individuals about, their lives. Mm-hmm.
And so this has been a big week for you, right, Giselle? You're an intern from Russell Sage at the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
Yes.
And what has it been like just jumping into this?
It's been actually really fun. I never thought that I would actually like to do radio shows, hosting, but yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
You know, that's the one thing about the Sanctuary. When you come here, you really jump in.
Yeah.
You know, there's no wading in the water. You get pushed into the deep end and you get to swim quickly, and there's people here to help you to, pull you out if you start to sink. It's a lot of love in this place. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll love it here.
Very true. So Giselle, if there's anyone who has a story, a personal story that they feel really needs to be told, how can they reach out to you and make sure that they can talk to you?
Through email. My email is guzmag2@sage.edu.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk family.
Thank you.
All right. Beautiful. So next we have, that concludes our show. Wow, it went too fast, man.
It certainly did.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Eric Newton. Remember to tune back in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also find more through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at mediasanctuary.org or just stop by at one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights. That's at 7:07 p.m., 7:07, right after the Sanctuary of Independent Media. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.